To continue our program this evening, it's very fitting that we have the following speaker for speaking about a new beginning. Her name is Arbutus O'Neill, and I use her full name on her request. She is an Al-Anon, and she was on Panel 1, an Al-Anon delegate to the World Service Conference. And that was the beginning. That was the first conference that they had. She was a representative, a delegate from Texas. She has also served as a trustee on Panel 10 of the World Service Board of Trustees from the Western United States. She has served in many capacities, but I'll let her tell you about that. Arbutus O'Neill.
Thank you, Florence. My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it's by the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon family groups. Thank you. I am powerless over alcohol. I am powerless over people, places, and things. And this is something that I have to admit, but more important, I must accept every single day of my life. A life that is unmanageable. Without the daily practice of the principles of a program that was given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would like to believe that the families of the very early AA members were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program had worked for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups, and more recently the Alateen groups, grew to reach all over the world and have shown such astounding results. I think it is generally believed that alcoholism is a family disease. And I sometimes get a little fearful that we emphasize that point too much and forget to let people know that the Al-Anon Family Group Program offers a program for family recovery. I think sometimes we talk too much about how sick we got and fail to tell people that we can get well. And that's why I think these weekend get-togethers are so very important. Because anyone who would like to come in this room tonight can see a whole room full of people who are getting well and having fun while they're doing it. I think some of the other people that are having conventions here this weekend might be having fun too, but I strongly suspect they're not getting very well. Maybe they'll join us a little later. I think I would be remiss indeed if I did not express my gratitude for having you all put me on your program this weekend. It was not my intentions to participate this week, and it's as much a surprise to me as it is to you. And I do indeed think the theme of this convention is very appropriate for Bill and me this weekend, because we're going to have to start all over again. That tornado that hit Wichita Falls the 10th of April didn't leave us much. It left us all the things that are important, however. We have each other. Our family was not injured, and Bill's collection of tapes stayed intact. I will not attempt to explain to you why that happened. I just know that it did. 4,600 reels were still in their shelves when the wind quit blowing. I said to my friends in Texas, and I don't think I need to explain to you that I'm not a Texan. I said to them, if you're trying to impress me, you can stop, because I'm impressed. I think one tornado is pretty bad, but when three at once hit you, it's tough. And I won't pretend that any other thing it could tell you that I was absolutely petrified. I have never been so scared in my life. If it lasted 3 minutes, no one could have stood it. They said the wind actually was there about 30 seconds, but it seemed to me like it was 10 years. And I've survived hurricanes, floods. I even survived an earthquake. And I'll take any one of them or all of them combined before I'll go through another hurricane. So indeed we are at the point in our life when we had thought that we could be little old ladies and a little old gentleman living out with some degree of serenity because of this program and not be a burden on our children, we'll have to start all over again. So it is indeed a new beginning. I'm not afraid of it because I have the people in this program here and other places that will sustain me until I can stand on my own two feet. And you've been doing that for half of my adult life. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups. And that doesn't mean very much to anyone unless you are a long-timer. I was hopeful that Elsa would get here this afternoon, and perhaps she is in the building. But except for Elsa Chamberlain, I know few people who've been in the Al-Anon family group program as long as I have. I'm looking forward to seeing her and visiting with her. I like open meetings best of all. The first meeting that I ever attended was an open meeting, and I still like them best of all, because I think it's in open meetings that the Al-Anon family group speaker can better reach the people who need to know about our program. And I hope some people here are here tonight who need our program. I would like to reach those of you who are not members of the Al-Anon family group, those of you who enjoy these weekend conventions, those of you who even go to open AA meetings with your AA spouse, but who do not know the joy of seeing a family put back together again because of the Al-Anon family group meetings. I hope some of you are here. I would like to reach those of you, too, who live with untreated alcoholism, those of you who live with people who may never stop drinking and who do not have the courage to face life. And I'd like to give you the assurance that you can find this courage in an Al-Anon family group meeting. And I would like to reach those of you, too, who are members of Al-Anon, those of you who are beginning to find your meetings a little monotonous, those of you who step aside when there's service tasks to be done, those of you who look me straight in the face and say, Arbus, I don't care anything about that old stuff. And I hope by the time I stop talking this evening that you will have changed your mind. Really, what I would like to do here this evening is two things. I would like to comfort the disturbed, and I would like to disturb the comfortable. I wonder if I would have something to do. That'd be fun. It's been my privilege and great joy to talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. And I know a great deal about people. People are all alike. Every one of you who are here this evening are here for exactly the same reason that I'm here. You were driven here under the cruel lash of alcoholism because you had no other place to go, just as I had no other place to go. I used to feel that alcoholism was a product of my generation, but that isn't true. Alcoholism is as old as time. Alcoholism is an insidious, progressive disease that causes the unthinking to make jokes about drunks, but it can leave families homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. And Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I have been able to learn, before our lifetime, before this generation, seemed to be able to do much about alcoholism. The priests and the ministers were baffled at their inability to cope with this insidious habit, this dreadful malady, if you please. They preached to the alcoholic. They prayed over him. And when these things failed, they damned your souls to hell. The men of science in other generations wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. And failing to do this, they said to the medical students before our generation, don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless. Preachment failed, and there was no cure. So there was only one other thing they knew to do with alcoholics. They must be punished. So we locked you up in jails. The more you drank, the longer you stayed in jail. And the longer you stayed in jail, the more you drank when you were finally released. It became a vicious cycle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. And society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. But there was one group of people who never quite gave up on the alcoholic. These were the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We bailed you out of jail. We pled with judges. We said, John's a good man when he's sober. And to complete this ridiculous paradox, we gave you hell every time you got drunk. And society was puzzled by the behavior of the families of alcoholics. For many, many generations, the families of alcoholics were the silent majority. Some people were surprised, I think, to even know that alcoholics have families. But they do. Real flesh and blood people who hurt and who were helpless to help you and who finally became hopeless. And the needs of the families of alcoholics went ignored even while we crowded the divorce courts, while we filled the welfare rolls, while our children appeared in juvenile court over and over and over again. And we tried to solve a problem that completely baffled the finest minds of the clergy, of the medical field, of the legislature, or a combination of these. And the only weapon that we had at our disposal was the fact that we loved the alcoholic. And we did not know that love was not enough. And the indifferent society that stood back and watched the families of alcoholics hung some ugly labels on us. Contributing factors, we were called. Aggravating influences. And such things. They were more puzzled by the behavior of the families of alcoholics than they ever were of the behavior of the alcoholic. Some of these people thought that we were endowed with some special quality that makes us better than other people, that we continue to love and care for alcoholics. There were some people that thought we were plain fools to live under such circumstances. I always say that my mother came in this group. She used to say that God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of Arbutus and Bill. And Mother was right, because God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. And then there was another very puzzling fact in this research, if you please, that they involved themselves in relative to the alcoholic and to the families. Some very brilliant, talented people were alcoholic, and this didn't fit the little perimeter that they wanted to fit you in. You know what alcoholics are supposed to be: dirty, low down, sorry, no account people. That's what an alcoholic is. Everybody knows that. But here they discovered that some very brilliant, talented people were alcoholic. And it was these brilliant, talented people who held the attention of an indifferent society until help came along for the rest of us. Did you ever think about that? Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He had conquered the whole known civilized world when he was 33 years old, and he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. The sweet singer of songs who gave the world its most beautiful folk music was a compulsive drinker. It seemed to come on him like a sickness, his wife once said, and so it does. They found Stephen Foster sickened to death on the New York Bowery, and when he was dead, they found in his pockets 38 cents. One penny for each year of a misspent life, and the lyrics to another song. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his genie with the light brown hair, but the love of his wife could not stop him drinking, and he died drunk. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories, and he all but destroyed himself with the magic that he found in the bottle. It could have been a fifth of gin or a quart of bourbon. And he describes the personality change of the alcoholic in the story Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched this personality change right in my own living room. Many of you out there saw it too. You saw the bottle change the man you love, or it could have been your beautiful wife, into a babbling idiot, into a degenerated animal, into a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, history says very little about the families of these men and others like them, but I believe that I know the loneliness and the fear that Jeannie knew when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from one of his sprees. And I believe that I know the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she left her home in California to go to a South Sea island in hopes that her husband might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He also had tuberculosis. And I believe that I know the joy that they both knew when he did regain his health. And I believe that I've found some of the serenity that they found when he found sobriety. Some of my Al-Anon friends ask me why I feel it necessary to give you a history lesson every time I walk up to a microphone. The truth of the matter is I can't tell jokes. I always forget the punchline. I tell you these things to point out a very significant fact. It is no longer necessary for a man or a woman to die in drunken ignorance as did Stephen Foster. Nor is it necessary for you to go to a South Sea island to find sobriety, because you can find it at the very closest meeting place. And these very same people who could do nothing at all about alcoholism in other generations are doing a great deal about alcoholism in our generation. Priests and ministers now feel that alcoholics are God's children too. And they send them to AA for treatment. They send their families to Al-Anon family group meetings so they can get well, too. It's possible now to get a man in a hospital with a simple diagnosis of alcoholism. This was not true only a few years ago down in the state of Texas. A doctor had to jeopardize his medical license and make a false diagnosis to even get treatment for an alcoholic. Now you can take them in the hospital and write on the chart alcoholism and get them treated. Penal institutions all over the country have fabulous rehabilitation programs in the institutions under the auspices of AA. They're doing marvelous work. It's very difficult to pick up a magazine or a newspaper anymore and not find an article on alcoholism. It seems to be the end thing now to be married to an alcoholic. If you don't have one in your family, go out and borrow one. A few years back, I'd have been most delighted to give you mine. But in spite of all the effort that's being made in all the professions, and please don't misunderstand me, I would not downgrade our friends in the profession. I was talking to Wes earlier this evening, and he reminded me that we should always remain friendly with our friends in the professions, and certainly I want to. I would not downgrade them for a second, but I simply have this to report. Regardless of all the effort that's being made and the fine talent that they have for doing these things, they're not getting the job done. They're simply not getting the job done. But when I look out at a room full of people like we have here this evening, I'm looking at a whole room full of experts. You're the people who know about alcoholism. You know about alcoholism because you've lived with it. You know the symptoms of alcoholism. You know the progression. You know about the alibi system in AA. You know about Slips. You know about drunken convulsions. Some of you, bless your heart, have lived through the terrors of DTs. There's not very much about alcoholism that you do not know because you've lived with it. And I learned this a long time ago. You see, when I came in this outfit, we didn't even have an outfit. When I came here, we didn't have Al-Anon family groups. We had a few scattered groups around over the country that we call various things. Some of them I can't repeat in polite society. But we were called our AA auxiliaries. We were called non-AAs. We were called wives groups. We were called this. We were called that. But there was no such thing as Al-Anon family groups. And we didn't have any literature. I mean, not one single piece of literature. I looked at your literature display this afternoon, and it's beautiful. Could you possibly imagine what it would be like to go to a meeting and not have one piece? That's what we did. We didn't have any literature at all. All we had, really, was the awareness of a great need and the dubious permission of a few very new AA people to come to their clubhouses while they had a meeting. And this is how we started. We went to these meetings, little alcoves around the country, usually very dirty, very hot or very cold, depending upon the season. And we sat together and we talked. Now, I'm not going to have to tell you what we talked about. We talked about the drunken exploits of the people we were married to. It was a kind of a morbid competition to see who lived with the sorriest man. These meetings were not very constructive, as you can well believe. But I get a little defensive about them, and I say to my Al-Anon friends, don't be too hard on those beginners, because if we had not been there, you wouldn't be here. And that's true. But we did have something going for us. We had two chapters in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The dear people who put the life-changing program of Alcoholics Anonymous seemed to know way back there before we even came along that someday we would become aware of this great need, and they made provisions for us because they wrote in that book two chapters for the families of alcoholics. I sometimes say Al-Anon is a kissing cousin to invention because we were both born of necessity. One of these chapters is called To the Wives. Now, that does not mean at any time to be a put-down to the beautiful men who are members of the Al-Anon family groups. The simple fact of the matter is that when this book was written, there were no women in AA. So they addressed this chapter to the wives of AA members. And the other chapter is entitled, To the Family Afterwards. And so we took these two chapters down in my part of the country, and we took from the chapter to the family afterwards one paragraph, and we made of it a little preamble that we used to open our meetings. And this is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. We feel that each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our lives worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. I haven't counted lately because it's been a while since I've been in service work, so I really don't know how many pieces of literature that the Al-Anon Family Group Headquarters has published at this point in time. I suspect it's over 100, and we have 6 hardback books. And when the delegates get back from New York, they'll bring our 7th one, which will be Lois's autobiography that we're all looking for. But in spite of this big stack of Al-Anon literature, I have yet to find one piece that more clearly points out to me what my responsibility to the families of alcoholics is, more clearly than the paragraph I just repeated to you. I have not found in any single piece of literature any way that I can show my gratitude for the sobriety in my home and for the good things that sobriety has brought in any piece of literature that we have. We don't use the big AA book very much in Al-Anon meetings anymore, and I think this is deplorable. And I'll have some repercussions about the next thing I'm going to say, and that's quite all right with me. After you've gone through a cyclone, you can stand a little criticism from Al-Anon people. But I believe with all my heart that if you do not study the first 164 pages of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't know anything at all about the program. There is no way on earth that you can study the principles of a philosophy if you don't know what the philosophy is. And the philosophy of the Alcoholics Anonymous program from whence we took our guidelines is in the first 164 pages of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. When I sponsor someone, that's the first thing I suggest that they do. I don't buy books for them anymore. I used to do that. But I suggest that they get themselves a big book and study the first 164 pages, and then we'll talk about this program. Because you can't learn a philosophy unless you read about it. And we've got one source and one source only. So you can quote me if you like. If you haven't read the big book, you don't know anything about the program. We don't use the paragraph that I repeated anymore for our preamble anymore. We simply say in Al-Anon family groups, we share with you our experience, strength, and hope in love. And I think that's what the committee wanted me to do when they wedged me in on your program. Share with you my experience, strength, and hope. And most certainly, I do it with love. I attended my first AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948, and I did not want to go to that meeting. The only reason that I went to that meeting is because I had put myself under an obligation to a very lovely lady, who was married to an AA member. And if you have not discovered it already, I will tell you that I'm a hillbilly, and hillbillies do not like to be obliged to anyone, so I went to the meeting. I didn't know much about alcoholics in those days, and I could not see any constructive purpose to be served in associating myself with a whole group of these people when I was having so much trouble with one of them. And I went to the meeting. It was open, as I said a moment ago, and I drank a lot of coffee. There's coffee in this cup. And after we were seated in a meeting, a very lovely lady that I learned later was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous leaned across Marguerite, who had taken me to the meeting, and she whispered to me. And what she said was, "How long's it been since you had a drink, honey?" And I wasn't embarrassed. I wasn't the slightest bit embarrassed. I'm not a teetotaler. I used to say I didn't trust teetotalers. But we've got a gal in my group down in Wichita Falls that is a teetotaler. She never even tasted whiskey in her whole life. And I would trust her with my life, so I don't say that anymore. But while I was trying to think of an answer, trying to remember when I'd had a drink, Marguerite was absolutely embarrassed to death, and she said to the lady, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. But she knows about alcoholism." I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My father was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to sing Irish folk songs, who taught me to love poetry, who had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, Dad turned into a devil. My father's alcoholism destroyed both my parents. My dad was a two-fisted construction man. He worked hard, and he played hard, and he drank hard. And he liked to build things for my mother. Dad was a craftsman, the likes of which you don't see in this generation. He used to say of wood, It has a beautiful fault. Dad would caress a piece of wood, much the same as a lady caresses a piece of velvet or a piece of satin. He loved wood. And he would literally spend months building for Mother a beautiful cabinet or a table. He would select the wood very carefully. He would sand it and polish it and put it together with great precision. And then he would smash it in a drunken rage. My father's alcoholism turned my mother into an old, ugly woman who hated him. She hated him as long as she lived. She hated him long after he was dead. And in the last years of her life that she spent in total darkness, she hated anyone who had ever loved John Martin, and that included me. And Dad was one of those people who wanted to make this program. But he never found this program. He used to come down to Texas and go to AA meetings with us. And when we'd come home from those meetings, he'd ask us a question. He would say to us, "How do you get the want to?" Dad never found the want to. And he never found the program. And for many years after I gained the courage to ask the God of my understanding for special favors, I used to close every day of my life with one special prayer. God, don't let my dad die drunk. Now, I cannot stand here and tell you why that is such a terror to those of us who love alcoholics. I can only tell you that it is. God, don't let my dad die drunk. My father died in 1965 of throat cancer. He did not die drunk. I do not tell you these things about my father or about my mother that you may weep for them, because my dad is all right, and so is my mother. My dad doesn't have to drink anymore, and my mother doesn't hate him. I tell you these things about my father and my mother that you may know that I have always loved an alcoholic. And because I love the alcoholic, I want to restore their families, because I believe with all my heart that of all the things an alcoholic loves, he loves his family most. Even when he tears us down over and over and over again, he loves his family most. Of this I am convinced. And I was not one earthly bit concerned about the drinking of this tall Texan who is the father of my children when we were married. I didn't mind that he drank. I knew he drank. But you see, he didn't drink like Dad did. And Father Joe Martin, that some of you might have heard, says that the only parallel we have is with the alcoholic that we know. Dad was a hallucinating drunk who saw creeping, crawling things. And I'm sure that Mother never could understand when her jaw was broken that he simply intended to kill a centipede that was crawling in her hair. And I'm not sure that I could have understood that. But Bill wasn't that kind of a drunk. Bill was a good time Charlie, if you please, who made everybody happy. I can remember occasion when we were in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, that he crashed a debutante's party. And I was just delighted. I knew those do-waggers up there would throw him out on his Texas, you know what. But they didn't. They just loved him. He taught those gals to put your little foot and the Texas stomp, and they just loved him. He spent 3 days with them. And people always said to me, "Why do you mind Bill drinking? He's so much fun." But you see, they didn't come home with him. They didn't see him suffer through the hangovers. They didn't see the aftermath of the drunks. I saw those. But I wasn't concerned with Bill's drinking. I drank with him. We drank everywhere we went. We worked with a group of people, and we were all about the same age, and we traveled all over the United States, and we got drunk everywhere we went. We'd been drunk in San Francisco, Chicago, San Antonio, everywhere. It seemed to be extremely important in my generation that people have fun. I heard an AA lady say one time that she had so much fun it almost killed her. And it almost killed Bill and me. But in 1940, two things happened to make us grow up. We became parents, and the world became involved in a war. And I quit drinking with Bill. No problem. I couldn't understand why he didn't quit drinking. We didn't know that he couldn't quit drinking. It took us a long time to learn that. We had our second child the next year, and Bill wasn't even there when Nancy was born. Nancy came on Wednesday and she met her father on Sunday. And when he came to the hospital with the usual paraphernalia that you men seem to think it's necessary to bring to us when we deliver your babies, you know, the red roses, the fancy nightgown and the perfume and all the stuff, he caused a great deal of confusion in the hospital. This is a Catholic hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he wanted to teach the little Catholic nun who was in charge of that maternity ward the Texas stomp. And the good sister didn't want to dance. And when they evicted him from that hospital, two big burly orderlies, at the insistence of the doctors, he sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window and forced the motorman to stop so he could tell him about our new baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. Then the next year, we had our only son. Took me a long time to get honest enough in this program to explain this rapid succession of small O'Neills. And I heard a lady say one time that she got a shotgun and tried to stop her husband drinking, and I suddenly realized that I had babies to sober Bill up. It didn't work. But when our little boy was born, the doctors told us that he would never walk. And the overwhelming guilt that I felt was beyond description. I knew that Bill wanted a son, and I wanted to produce a son for my Bill. And I did. A son that was crippled. And I've watched Bill stand by this child's crib, this golden-haired little boy who couldn't kick, and go out and get drunk. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. But she knows about alcoholism. And then when our fourth child, another little girl, was born in 1943, the things changed. When I stand and tell this dreary story, it sounds like it took 10,000 years. It didn't. I watched this bright young man from Texas, who was at the top of his profession when I met him, hit the skids, and it was faster than I can describe. By the time that Teresa was born in 1943, he'd started having personality clashes with the people he worked for, and it was necessary for him to change jobs pretty often. And one of these jobs took us down to Knoxville, Tennessee during the war. They just brought that atomic energy plant in there, and Bill worked for Holland Furnace Company. He had a good job with them. He worked on commission. He always liked to do that. He could set his own pace. And it was not unusual, even in those years, for Bill to make $600 or $700 a week, plus what he took under the table if someone needed a furnace pretty bad. He wasn't above that. And we were evicted from a furnished house in Knoxville, Tennessee, that rented for $50 a month for non-payment of rent. Bill couldn't spare the money to pay the rent. And then I was to become familiar with eviction notices and with welfare agencies. And I'm not sure that my friends in Texas have quite appreciated this part of my story, because I don't think there's anyone in the world who quite feels the humiliation and the shame that a hillbilly feels when they have to ask for charity. But you'll do it. Yes, you will. You'll go to a charitable institution to feed your children and to get help for your young son. Yes, you will. And I watched the look of pity and disgust on the social worker's face when she wrote on my application blank, "Husband is a drunkard." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholics. And again, I was to see the eviction notices, and I was to see the look of pity and disgust on these people's faces when they were forced to serve these things, and the deep resentment and the shame that I felt, again, I cannot describe. And I would like you to know that when I came to the state of Texas in 1944, I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time. I watched this boy lose everything he had that he wanted to keep, and he could not quit drinking. Bill lost his left eye as a result of drinking. and he couldn't stop. And he lost his left arm as a result of drinking. And he couldn't stop. He lost his self-respect, respect of his family. He lost his self-confidence. He lost the motivation to live. And he could not stop drinking. When you see Bill go across the lobby of a hotel with a tape recorder under his arm, it doesn't seem too sad that a middle-aged man has an empty sleeve. But would you like to know how old he was when he lost that arm? 27 years old. 27 years old. And I was 22. And there wasn't anybody to tell us about this thing. And don't think we didn't try. I went to everyone I knew just to find out something that could be done. And it wasn't because they didn't want to help us. It was because they couldn't help us. They didn't know the answers. And we didn't either. And I've heard AA members stand behind podiums like this throughout the length and breadth of our country and have the unmitigated gall to say that non-alcoholics don't know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I watched this boy lose everything he had, and I wanted to help him with every fiber of my being, and I could not. I could not help Bill because he wouldn't let me. And when you indict the families of alcoholics, those of you who are AA members, please remember that we wanted to help you, but we couldn't get through to you. You wouldn't let us. It was like you put us on the other side of a thick glass wall, and we could see you, and we could hear you. We're not insensitive, calloused people. We know the anguish you suffer. We know the mental torture you go through. Remember, when we're looking down at you, we're sober. We knew these things, but we couldn't help you because you wouldn't let us. It's like the feeling you have when you tend a sick child. You want to help the child. The little person is burning up with fever, and it cries, and you want to help the baby, but you can't, because the baby can't tell you where it hurts. And the alcoholic couldn't tell us where they hurt, and we couldn't help them. And this hopeless, helpless feeling that those of us who love alcoholics live with day after day, week after week, month after month, year after miserable year, has no parallel at all. This hopeless feeling takes away our very reason for being. It leaves us empty. It makes us nothing. And that was the state of being that I knew when we came to the state of Texas. And I met a strange group of people who called themselves AAs. And they seemed to know what I was talking about. There was no Al-Anon family groups then, but these AA people seemed to know what I was talking about, and they at least listened to me. But they couldn't help me. Not entirely. It seemed to me that they took me up to the kind of an edge of a precipice. They didn't push me over, but I kind of dangled there because I couldn't identify with them. And I never shall forget the first AA member I ever talked to. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon, and he talked about this program. The only thing I knew to call it in those years was a rehabilitation program. I know that's kind of sticky, but that's all I knew to call it. And after about 2.5 hours, I asked him, I said, "What do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and children of alcoholics?" And the question surprised him. No one had ever asked him that before. And he said to me, "We don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem." Dear God, you do not have a problem. At that moment, I couldn't wear a sleeve on my arms because of a rash that the doctor said was caused by nerves. I couldn't stand in my own shoes. And this dear AA member said to me, "You do not have a problem." I thought he was wrong. I still think he was wrong. And I believe it was on that self-same cold November afternoon in a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas. I thought he was wrong. I still think he was wrong. And I believe it was on that self-same cold November afternoon in a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas, that I made up my mind that someday, someday, somehow, I would find a way to help families of alcoholics. And by the grace of God, that opportunity came to me, because then I met another group of people. And this indeed was a weird bunch of folks. As I told you before, they didn't even have a name. But these people found it vitally necessary to practice the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to preserve their sanity and to restore them to sanity. These people entertain the same fears as does the alcoholic. These people cultivate the same resentment and develop the same self-pity as does the alcoholic. There was only one difference. These people did not have the allergy to booze, and this was the most revolting development of all, because this meant that we had to take our punishment standing up, cold sober. And there's not an alcoholic in the world that can do it, not without help. And we couldn't either. We just thought we could. Oh, we were smug in those days. We used to stand up and say, "But families of alcoholics do not show the physical manifestations of the illness." And we can't even say that anymore, because some of the people in the Al-Anon family groups are getting to be middle-aged folk, and they're finding themselves in hospital wards with such things as ulcerated stomach caused by tension. We're having people in Al-Anon family groups to have sudden heart attacks caused by tension. We're even having Al-Anon members wind up on the back wards of mental institutions because they can't cope with this problem. So we can't even say that we do not suffer the physical manifestations of the illness. Not anymore, we can't. Some of these people, it seemed to me, were born with an understanding heart. And the rest of these people seemed to have developed this understanding because they had lived with a serious illness and sometimes with tragedy. And I knew these people. I knew these people. I was drawn to them. These people could give me a reason for living one day at a time. These people could give me the courage to face life. And when I came to these people, I was totally and utterly destitute. I had no faith in God. I didn't trust people. I had no confidence in my young husband's sobriety. Oh, I believe there was a God, with the definition that an agnostic is one who does not know God. I was agnostic. I knew there was a God. I thought he created the universe, if you please. I thought he put the planets here. I thought that he changed the seasons and turned the nights, the days into night, and I thought he hung out the stars to make it pretty for us, and I even thought he put people here, and then he let us go to hell backward. But I had absolutely no concept of a personal contact with God, none at all. I know now, of course, that I tried to pray when I was cold, scared, and sometimes hungry, and I know now, of course, that God heard me. I think God listens very carefully for the prayers of the beginner. And I think he listens very carefully to the prayers of the alcoholic. And I think he heard me when all I could say was, "Oh God, oh God." And he knew why I couldn't trust people. I've already told you that people do not deal very kindly with families of alcoholics. He knew why I couldn't trust people. I couldn't even trust myself. I was not responsible for the things that I did, and I was not responsible for the things that I said. And I want to make one point perfectly clear to you tonight. I did not come to the family group meetings, as they were called in those early days,
to get my husband sober. I came here to try to find the disintegrated pieces of a personality that once was me, and I somehow had lost along the way. And they were writing a lot of articles in the mid-40s and the early 50s about group therapy in the field of mental health, and that's what I thought these family group meetings were, and in a sense, that's what they are. And so I came to these meetings because I didn't like the unlovely person that I had become. I came to these meetings because our four lovely children were afraid of me, and my husband, who was now sober in AA, was ashamed of me. And I didn't want my children to be afraid of me, and Lord knows they had good reason to be scared. I punished them unmercifully if they spilled a glass of milk on a white tablecloth, and I insisted on the white tablecloth. I don't know why. I have no explanation for that. It doesn't make sense to me that you'd try to prove to your own children that you're an aristocrat, but I did. If they brought home a C on a grade card, they were in bad trouble, because I would not tolerate failure. Failure had been bred out of me. We don't fail back in the hills. We get an equalizer, but we don't fail. And I would not tolerate this in my children. And they were scared to death of me. And Bill was ashamed. He was ashamed of my outbursts of temper. He was ashamed of the attitude that I took toward tradespeople and business people. Totally unpredictable. And so I came to these meetings. Excuse me. And I listened with tongue in cheek, I'm afraid, when they talked about prayer and meditation, because I didn't believe them. But they told me that if I'd put the principles of this program to work in my life, that it would change. And that's what I wanted to happen. Even then, I was looking for a new beginning. And I had a gray-eyed sponsor from Texas who put my nose down in those 12 steps, and I had the distinct feeling that if I didn't take them, she wouldn't let me up for air. And I was going to take those steps like I'd always done everything. I was going to make an A+. I was going to slap it down in front of her and get my A+ and say, see, they didn't work. And they did. Now, don't misunderstand me. It was not an overnight transition. The first thing that I noticed was that my children could relax around me. They finally became so relaxed that they sassed me. They had to preface those little sassy remarks, though. They'd say, Mother, I know this is sassing, but... And they could get by with it. And then a little later, I was conscious of the fact that, once again, Bill was proud of me. And this is extremely important to me. I think it's extremely important to all of us who love alcoholics. The approval. This sick need for approval that we develop is a real sickness in itself, I think. And I think there's a good reason for it. Because, you see, in our society, in our culture, about the sorriest person on earth is a drunk. Agreed? You just can't be much sorrier than a drunk. But then you all rejected us. So this approval, we don't need very much of it, but we do need it. You know, you just have to occasionally say you did a good job, or that was a nice supper, or you look nice, or you smell pretty. That's about all we need. But the sick need for approval is still there in a lot of us. And I was very grateful when I knew that once again Bill was proud of me. And Lord knows I was grateful for the fact that the children could love and respect me once more. But these were not nearly so important as the fact that I belonged to something. You see, I never belonged anywhere in my life. I grew up in construction camps across this country. And we never lived anywhere. We had a home base back in the Carolinas, but we were always on the move. Didn't live in a community very long. Didn't go to one school over one semester until I was high school age. Didn't go to church, because you don't go to church when you don't believe in God. Never belonged anywhere at all. But now you see, I belong to the most important thing in the world. I belong to the Al-Anon family group. And I expect you know by now that I'm pretty much of a fan of Al-Anon family groups. Al-Anon family groups people are a little different from AA people. Have you noticed that? There's no quitters in the Al-Anon family group. No quitters. I don't know what happens to them, bless their heart, but they don't make it in Al-Anon. We don't quit loving the alcoholic. And we don't quit hoping that someday he'll recover. And we don't quit helping them. Our methods get a little drastic, of course, but we don't quit helping them. But I think the most important thing is that we don't quit loving you. There's no quitters in the Al-Anon family groups. And I belong to this group. When I was 10 years in this program, I was privileged to serve as a delegate from Texas. And I went to the World Service Conferences, and I met Bill and Lois Wilson. I met delegates from other parts of the country. And this was very important to me, because then I knew I had friends all over the world. And some of you told me that you liked me, and then I could belong to the human race. And you told me that if I'd put the principles of this program to work in my life, that it would be my privilege to rear those four children. And that's exactly what happened. The tools of this program made it possible for me to rear those four children, and I'd stack them up with any four in the world. We have three daughters and a son. Two of our daughters are in the educational field. Our number three daughter graduated from the University of Magna Cum Laude, and we felt that wasn't bad for a drunk's kid. One of our daughters is married to a young psychiatrist who treats alcoholics very successfully, supplementing their psychotherapy treatments with AA meetings. And my son told me I had to change my story, and so I do. For those of you who've heard me before, I used to say that our only son weighed into the Navy at 189 pounds, his frail little boy who couldn't walk, and that he lived in Austin, Texas with his lovely wife and a beautiful new home and a nice business. And those things are basically still true. But Luther O'Neill picked up a 30-day AA chip the 12th day of February. He now belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will say to you, I'm extremely grateful for that. But I want you to know, for several months this year, I was going around thinking things at God Almighty, and what I was thinking was this, you know, enough's enough already. My dad was an alcoholic. My Bill's an alcoholic. Do I have to go through this for the third generation? And I'm extremely grateful that Luther didn't have to hit bottom. I do not think it's necessary for an alcoholic to have to go down as far as Bill did. Luther's never got a parking ticket in his life, and he doesn't need to because of this program. He doesn't have to lose that lovely wife and little boy. He doesn't have to lose his business because of the AA program, and I'm so grateful for it. But he reminded me that I had to change my story, and so I'll tell him that I did. I think another thing that I would like to say to you is this. The principles of this program carries a message that the whole world needs to know. And there's people right here in this pretty little town up here in the mountains where you live that will die in drunken ignorance, never knowing they're alcoholic. And there's people in other cities around the world. Unless we carry the message. And there's people in this beautiful little city and in every other city in the world that I know anything at all about who will not have the courage to face life one more day with an alcoholic, and they'll break up their homes if we fail to carry this message. And there's kids here in your town. We're going to hear some of them this weekend. There's kids in this town who will grow up with deformed personalities. Kids that are afraid for their dad to come home at night, or it could be their mother. And these kids will grow up with deformed personalities if we fail to carry this message. And if we fail to reach these people, may God have mercy on them, and may God have mercy on us.